Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, we're devoting the entire half hour to a disease which is expected to escalate rapidly in the coming years as the baby boom generation ages. In the next 35 years, the number of individuals age 65 and older diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease may nearly triple. It's an issue many families are already dealing with.
Quite often, the first sign of Alzheimer's is memory loss, and the disease may seem to appear out of the blue. But in fact, Alzheimer's disease is slow growing and starts in the brain up to 20 to 30 years prior to symptoms. Making brain-healthy lifestyle choices, including changes in dietary and nutritional habits, may delay the onset of, or perhaps prevent, Alzheimer's. Eventually, the disease eats away at memories, relationships with loved ones, and one's sense of self. In many ways, family caregivers, spouses, children, relatives, suffer more than Alzheimer's patients because they're the ones who recognize the decline and feel those losses.
Joining us for a discussion of Alzheimer's, including symptoms, treatment, nutritional intervention, the emotional impact of the diagnosis, and the challenges of caregiving, are two guests who approach the disease from two different perspectives. Dr. Richard Isaacson is director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic, Weill Cornell Memory Disorders Program, at the New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center. His research focuses on nutrition and dietary interventions for Alzheimer's disease management. He's the author of two best-selling books geared for patients and caregivers, Alzheimer's Treatment, Alzheimer's Prevention, and The Alzheimer's Diet.
Also with us is Dr. Dale Atkins, a licensed psychologist whose work focuses on families aging well, managing stress, and living with Alzheimer's. She's appeared on CNN, Oprah, NBC's Today Show, and ABC's Good Morning America. Dr. Atkins is the author of half a dozen books that cover topics such as parent-adult-child relationships.
Welcome to Take Care, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us on today.
Dr. Isaacson, let's start with you. So many people complain of memory loss as they get older, and they fear that they may have or may be getting Alzheimer's disease. What is Alzheimer's, and how is it different than age-related memory loss?
Great question. Alzheimer's disease is a progressive neurological disorder. And what that means is memory loss happens, but it gets progressively worse over time. And it doesn't just affect the memory, but it affects other things. And it really leads to the someone not being able to take care of themselves. When someone gets older, it's common for things to be on the tip of our tongue or to misplace something but find it later. Those are things that can be associated with normal aging or age-related memory loss, and the two are quite different.
So then how do you as a medical doctor make that diagnosis?
So the best way that a doctor will do it is just to take a history, talking to the patient, talking to the family members, really just trying to figure out when the memory loss started, what else is happening, or is the person depressed, can the person sleep at night, have the behaviors changed, do they get lost while driving, can they take care of themselves at home. Those types of things are a little bit more suggestive of Alzheimer's disease. But if someone has more sporadic memory loss, it may be just suggestive of typical changes with age. What they'll then do is we'll do a physical examination, we can order some laboratory studies. There are some vitamin deficiencies, thyroid trouble, for example, that can cause memory issues. And then after that, I'll do a brain imaging study or an X-ray of the brain, usually an MRI. Other people sometimes can do a CAT scan. But basically, this will be the center of my intervention.
So in some ways, the initial part is like a diagnosis of exclusion. But when you do an MRI or a CAT scan, what are you looking for? Are there changes in the brain that you're now seeing?
So based on the guidelines, and we're just trying to figure out if anything big and bad is going on. Is there a tumor or a big stroke or something like that? And most of the time, we don't find something like that. And if we check for thyroid function or vitamin levels, most of the time, we also don't find an abnormality there. Roughly about 5, maybe 10% of the time do we find something on those lab or X-ray studies. The rest of the time, it may not be a medical cause of the memory loss, but it could actually be something called a neurodegenerative dementia. What that means is something like Alzheimer's or something like a dementia with Lewy body or frontotemporal. And I can name all these different names, but Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. Dementia means problems with memory or thinking skills that lead to someone not being able to take care of themselves. There's lots of different causes of dementia, but Alzheimer's is the most common form. So in some ways, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. We don't have the perfect test yet to figure out if someone has actually Alzheimer's disease, but we try to do the best we can with the test that we order.
I know this is so not scientific, but I've read and heard of something regarding protein, some special protein that's in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. Can you just explain that? There might be other people in the listening audience that have heard of that as well.
Yep, and this protein is called amyloid, and the amyloid protein builds up abnormally in the brain. And you said something right at the beginning of the show, Alzheimer's disease, in my opinion, and based on the guidelines, basically state that you don't just develop memory loss and develop Alzheimer's disease overnight. Alzheimer's can start in the brain over 20 years before the first symptom of memory loss. And I think what we're finding is that amyloid protein can certainly, and as it builds up, what I believe is that if the amyloid builds up, it's kind of like if you don't take the garbage out, you're going to get sick. And amyloid is that garbage, and it builds up. And if you can get rid of the garbage, maybe the person will do better. But even before the amyloid protein builds up, there are other changes that we've noticed in the brain having to do with glucose and glucose metabolism. And I actually think that Alzheimer's starts way before the protein gets deposited. And I think this is a key question in science today.
Now, what do you do when you make a diagnosis of Alzheimer's? Do you move directly into treatment? Is there treatment? What is the conventional therapy these days?
So there's no magic bullet and no magic cure or no magic way to prevent Alzheimer's disease. It's not like that. But I can tell you that in my personal life, and I know Dr. Atkins too, we have been personally affected by Alzheimer's disease. I have four family members that have struggled with Alzheimer's disease. And just like there's no one magic thing, you have to take a comprehensive multimodal approach. It's kind of like fighting a battle. My Uncle Bob, who had Alzheimer's disease, he was in the Navy, and my dad was in the Coast Guard. You win a battle by, I'm a peaceful person, but you win a battle by taking the Coast Guard and the Navy and the Air Force, the Marines and the Special Forces. Same thing with Alzheimer's disease. Now, there are pharmacologic approaches that include FDA-approved drugs, several vitamins, medical food, supplements, and then there's the non-pharmacologic approaches, which are absolutely as important. Nutrition, diet is key. Exercise on a regular basis, keeping the brain active. There's so many things. And then, of course, caregiver support. And, Dale Atkins can definitely speak on this, but you have to treat the whole person, you treat the whole patient, and you treat the whole family. That's the only way that we can truly make progress with Alzheimer's.
Well, we are looking forward to talking to Dr. Atkins, but I do have to go back to your Uncle Bob because you have discussed him quite a bit, and I found the whole story striking. He saved your life when you were a young child. You were drowning in a swimming pool.
Yep, absolutely. I was 3 years old. I was in the back of my Aunt Carol's house in Huntington, Long Island, New York. And as my cousin Jeff, I have to give my cousin Jeff a little bit of credit. He actually ran in to call for help when my Uncle Bob jumped in the pool. I was literally three and was at the bottom. So this completely happened. I remember it anytime I go near water because I still don't go near water. I hate swimming. I have a little bit of PTSD from it. But absolutely, Uncle Bob was literally the life of the party. He was the funnest, most happiest guy. He also introduced my parents. So if it wasn't for him, in a couple ways, I'll put it that way, I wouldn't be here, actually. So Uncle Bob was the first person to ever actually see me, with this disease. And I mean, it took him from the happiest, sweetest, most lovable, amazing guy, unfortunately, to a shell of himself, 8, 10 years after having the disease. So this is not the same disease as when my Uncle Bob had the disease. Back then, when I was in high school, there was zero treatments. There was no drugs. There was nothing. There was nothing on the horizon. In 2014, Alzheimer's disease is a different disease. We don't have a cure, and we can't prevent it for sure, but there are absolutely things that anyone can do to take better care of themselves and also to treat the disease more effectively.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness from WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
This half hour, we're discussing Alzheimer's disease from both the patient's and the family caregiver's perspective. Our guests are Dr. Richard Isaacson, director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center, and Dr. Dale Atkins, a psychologist who's worked with patients and families dealing with an Alzheimer's diagnosis. Dr. Atkins, we can talk about diagnosis and treatment, and we can be clinical about it. But really, any diagnosis of a chronic or terminal illness is very, very hard to face. And knowing that you will eventually lose your memory and your ability to recognize loved ones, that's just, to me, that is so unfathomable and frankly terrifying. In your experience, how do Alzheimer's patients and family members handle this news? Do they grieve, or are they spurred to action? Do they marshal their resources, and do they prepare for the future?
You know, they do every and all, and it depends on the family. It depends on the person. It depends so much on the way they engage with life and have engaged with life. And much of it, as Richard alluded to, depends on the family and the support system. You know, some people see things and they don't see them. They see them and they don't want to admit them. Or they say, well, you know, everybody gets older and everybody forgets. And that's true. But what happens really is a person generally starts to notice things and tries to work hard to prevent having other people recognize what's going on with them. So they might get very short-tempered because they may lose something and then say, you took it. Or, you know, why did you make it difficult for me to do something? And there could be a lot of blaming. But for a person to understand what's actually going on with them is really devastating. And I think what's important is to pay attention to what Richard said, which is this is not necessarily your grandmother's Alzheimer's. This is a very different time when we can give support and we can take action and really try and help an entire family deal with something. Because in the past, people were very isolated. And one of the major problems with caregiving is not only the caregiver's isolation, but friends retreating from a person who has Alzheimer's because they themselves can't deal with what they're dealing with. They can't see their friend waste away. You know, Richard used a comment that's a very common descriptor, and it's the person becomes a shell of him or herself. And one of the things that's difficult is to try and appreciate that we must look at the strengths that still remain rather than focus on that which is missing, that which where the holes are. And we can do that by maintaining an attitude of positive connection with the person of their essence, knowing what they love, going back to what they always enjoyed, a type of music, a type of art, kind of playfulness, whatever it is, engaging them and keeping their dignity and keeping them in the room. For me, it's always sad when people talk about a person who's sitting right next to them and, you know, as if they're not there or not asking their opinions about things and keeping them vital and vibrant and socially engaged. So these are some of the things that I think we can do to be sensitive to a positive way of dealing with Alzheimer's.
So you counsel family members to not withdraw, and that would go for friends also. And when you talk about specific suggestions you have by talking about things that you know they've enjoyed, what are some other suggestions that you make to caregivers who are spending time, whether it's a family member or a friend with Alzheimer's?
To take care of themselves and to do the things that they love to do every day, to get support. You know, very often in families, so many families live far away from one another these days. It's not everybody, all the generations living in the same block. But really engaging resources that you may not even know are available to you. There are so many people who have been caregivers. There are so many people who want to be helpful in some ways to make your life easier, you know, to streamline your life. And again, you know, if you like to work out, to work out. If you don't like to work out anyway, because what happens is, you know, you really change the body chemistry when you are doing something that is physically active, to eat right. It's very important that caregivers do not fall into a depression. Very often we worry that the person who has Alzheimer's is, you know, they're going to be okay, but the caregiver is going to be so stressed and depressed and isolated that we're going to lose them. And very often adult children worry about both of their parents if one parent is the primary caregiver. So I like to have people never, never lose contact with their friends, doing things that are important to them and getting respite care when necessary, or getting other people to come in and help with their loved ones. There are some adult daycare programs that can be very, very helpful resources in the area. And, you know, if you like to read, if you like to sing, very often I find that caregivers, when they take care of themselves, come back refreshed to be the caregiver. And then they can laugh and they can do things with their loved one. They listen to music. They watch old movies that they enjoyed. And is it exactly the same experience? No. But can it be a different and enriched experience? Absolutely. Very often caregivers find resources within themselves that they didn't know they had. They relate to their loved one in a very different way. Patience and caring and taking time, maybe cooking together, gardening together, doing things together in addition to doing things on their own that keep them aware that there are other parts of themselves. They're not just the caregiver.
Dr. Isaacson, is the cognitive decline that occurs in Alzheimer's patients similar across the board? How long a process, and what can we expect?
There's a saying, once you've seen one person with Alzheimer's, you've seen one person with Alzheimer's.
Good one.
I mean, it's truly like that. My Uncle Bob, one way. My dad's cousin, another way. It's a different disease in different people. I think the progressive nature of the disease is common. I think the rapidness or the rapidity that it progresses is different. One person may get Alzheimer's and have one specific gene and behave one specific way. Another person differently. If someone has diabetes or cholesterol, high cholesterol or high blood pressure, those patients are going to probably decline more rapidly. In certain patients, you can do everything right. The patient can do everything right. The family, I can make the best recommendations. Because of their genes, they may not respond as well. Other patients may do nothing right and may go pretty slowly along the course. So it's really patient-dependent.
So a family history of Alzheimer's disease must increase one's risk of developing the disease, and you've been open about your personal experience with it in your family. So when I can ask this question in two ways. I could say, what advice do you give people to try to prevent or stave off the beginning of Alzheimer's? Or I could ask you, what are you doing in your life since this hits so close to home? And whatever you say, I'm going to start doing.
Well, don't do anything without under the guidance of your own treating physician. But in my life, basically, if Alzheimer's disease is going to start 20 to 30 years before symptoms, then that's when I'm going to start making the brain healthy changes. And right around the age of 32 is when I kind of changed the way I eat, changed what I do, and changed everything. I take a pretty aggressive approach in my patient population as well as in my own life. Some people say, do as I say, not as I do. I actually, for the most part, do it. Brain healthy lifestyle. What does that mean? Exercise on a regular basis, 2 to 3 times a week. 30 minutes is better than 15, and 45 to 60 minutes, 3, 4, 5 times a week, better than 15 or 30. Eating a brain healthy diet, green leafy vegetables on a regular basis. Eat Mediterranean style, plant based foods. Red meat in moderation, less is more. Lean proteins is better. Wine in moderation. I can't do wines, it gives me headaches. But, you know, alcohol, one drink a day in women, 1 to 2 in men is probably okay. A mocha for your memory. A dark cocoa powder absolutely can not only fight memory loss, but also improves blood pressure control and that thing called insulin resistance. And insulin and glucose has a big relation to this disease, too.
Can I just jump in really, really quickly?
Please.
As a chocolate
Please.
Lover? So it would be dark. It would be. Let's get the specifics on the chocolate.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Atkins, you can relate to my approach. Right? Now, I have tried, just for the listener, I mean, I have tried the 70% cocoa powder and candy, and I must say it's just not as tasty, the more concentrated.
Right.
Do the studies show that it really has to be a minimum of 70%?
The problem with chocolate bars and chocolate in general is if you look on the nutrition label, it has sugar and butter and sugar and butter and then the cocoa powder. The key here is the dark cocoa powder, and there's actually randomized studies, real high-quality studies. Dark cocoa powder, and I mix it with coffee in the morning. You can mix it in a smoothie. You can mix it with, hey, make it brain healthier, add blueberries and strawberries. Blueberries and strawberries on a regular basis can delay cognitive decline by up to 2 years. So you add the dark cocoa powder, not necessarily the 70% cocoa chocolate bar, to some sort of way to make it palatable, that's when it can have the brain healthy properties.
Thank you for explaining that.
Absolutely. But, you know, as my mom said, everything in moderation. What I try to advocate for my patients is make every meal brain healthier. I teach them about good carbohydrates versus bad carbohydrates, the high fructose corn syrup, white breads, white pastas. They're empty calories. The extra sugar, it just doesn't do anything good for you except for add pounds to the belly and make your insulin spike. And insulin spikes probably lead to inflammation in the brain and increase your likelihood of Alzheimer's. The good carbohydrates are better, not the bad empty carbs. So there's a lot of ways to look at things. There's good fats, there's bad fats, omega-3 fatty acids. Those are the good ones. You know, avocados in moderation, olive oil. Those are the good fats. Learn the differences and try to make every meal a little bit brain healthier.
All right, Dr. Atkinson, so you're talking about this diet for prevention. How about for the patient with Alzheimer's?
So when it comes to the patient with Alzheimer's, my recommendations are a little bit, I guess I would say, stronger slash different. If I'm trying to actually improve someone's memory who already has memory trouble, my brain-healthy dietary things will be similar but a little bit more comprehensive. One way is really reducing carbohydrate. Someone once called it an early bird special diet. My whole family moved from Brooklyn to Boca Raton, Florida, and you can save a dollar but also may actually help in your memory. If you stop eating carbohydrates after, say, 7 or 8 p.m. At night, and you don't eat any carbohydrates again until 7, 8 o'clock in the morning, that's 12 to 14 hours where your brain is not really not just having extra calories, but also using a backup fuel. I use the analogy of a hybrid car. Gas is like sugar. That's what the brain usually uses for fuel. But the battery is like ketone bodies, and ketone bodies is a way to have a cleaner burning fuel. So one way in my Alzheimer's patients that actually have memory trouble and not just trying to prevent it is trying to really reduce the carbohydrates much more. I'll have them see a certified nutritionist, potentially even use more aggressive ways to induce ketosis, and sometimes we'll even prescribe a medical food to help with the ketones.
Dr. Atkins, you were very specific and helpful earlier in talking about the process of caregiving, you know, among family members. But at some point, you won't be able to do it in your home anymore. And how do you know when caregiving has to move to the next level and that you need professional help, either part-time or in a facility?
I think it's a great question. And again, for every family, it's different. But, you know, someone once said to me, and this person was my mother, when he doesn't recognize me anymore, that's when we'll make the change. Well, fortunately, in our family, my mother felt he always recognized her, and we were able to have people come and help in our home. So my dad actually stayed in our home for the 13 years that he was ill. And I think that depending on the kinds of support you have and how it's affecting you, the major caregiver, that's how you make those decisions. But it's wonderful and important to be able to see what resources are around. Very often I'll work with families and they say, no, I can't even think about that. And I'll say, well, what is the harm of thinking of something? What is the harm of finding out what resources are available? And because there's a kind of a desensitization process. If you go and you visit a place, a daycare facility, for instance, or a long-term assisted living facility, for instance. We all have said in our minds, or most of us, my person whom I love will stay with me forever. And that may be so. However, the question is whether or not you're able to do what the person needs and what's best for the person. So each one has to make those decisions on their own, but there are lots and lots of resources that most of us don't even know exist. They are community-based, they are often church-based or synagogue-based, and sometimes small respites can be very helpful and give people energy and vitality to do caregiving with help while keeping a person at home. Additionally, though, if a person really isn't able to stay at home, there are lots of other options. And I have an aunt right now, my father's sister, who's staying in a group home. And there are five women who are very well taken care of, and they live in a home together. And this is the option for her children who live three blocks away. And it's all Alzheimer's oriented. So there are lots of different kinds of programs that we need to pay attention to. But I think the most important thing is to keep one's fingers on one's own pulse and see how you're doing from day to day. There's a tremendous amount of disappointment, and there's a tremendous amount of adaptation to that which kind of we didn't expect. But there also can be a reaching in and connecting with someone as they decline by keeping them safe, by keeping yourself connected and by bringing in other people who you might not have known could be available as resources. It's a journey, and it can be a very frightening one, but it also can be one where you can feel connected in a way that you never knew was possible.
Dr. Richard Isaacson is director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center and author of two books on Alzheimer's disease written for patients and caregivers. And Dr. Dale Atkins is a psychologist who's worked with patients and families dealing with an Alzheimer's diagnosis. I know the two of you are working on a new project and that you've created a new website around that. We're going to be putting that up on our webpage to let our listeners know what to expect. But thank you both so much for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.